It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll take a break from the news for a little bit and talk about pie on this week's edition of Food Friday. First, we'll stick with the biggest news in the U.S. right now, Tuesday's general election. Not about the results or candidates themselves. We're going to take a look at misinformation and falsehoods that have been spread following the close of the election. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you seeing a lot of misinformation or sketchy claims since Election Day? What questions do you have about how to spot these kind of things? How would you like this misinformation to be handled now and in the future? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Howard Hardy is the Elections Integrity Reporter at Wisconsin Watch. Howard, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Margot Suska is Assistant Professor of Journalism at American University in Washington, D.C. She's also an assessor for Poynter's International Fact Check Network. Margot, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Margot, before we get into some specific claims out there, I wanted to ask you, in general, what are good ways for people in the media to talk about and report on false claims without risking spreading those false claims while they're doing it?
Well, I mean, I think that's an excellent question. And it's interesting today when you were seeing some of the media coverage, well, last night and today, some of the media coverage of Donald Trump's press conference, where you had actual news outlets turn off the live feed because what he was saying was filled with lies. We saw that word today, lies, and it's been very rare where you've seen news organizations that have actually pointed out what this administration has done actually being a lie. And it's interesting to me, after 4 years, we're finally seeing the news media doing, I think, what it should have been doing all along, which was calling out blatant falsehoods from this administration. And I think it's very, you know, it's the language that gets used. It's the way the stories are framed, and, you know, our citizens deserve the truth, and they deserve a media system that's going to hold this government and any government accountable.
Now, Howard, you've been following misinformation in Wisconsin in the run-up to the election as it's going on. Are we seeing a big burst of false claims spreading around now that the polls have closed this week?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there were all sorts of bogus rumors floating around, particularly on Wednesday morning. But the big one that really took off was that Wisconsin's voter turnout exceeded the number of registered voters in the state, which is false on its face and easily refuted by checking the Wisconsin Election Commission's website. Disinformation like this is really alarming when it presents an obvious harm to the public. And this particular tweet, like so many of the social media posts and kind of faux news stories that we've seen over the past few days, was attempting to undermine the confidence of the vote in a swing state with a razor-thin margin. So the stakes are obviously really high. That's why Wisconsin Watch decided to pull the trigger on publishing a debunk-style story. The content contained demonstrably false information, was created with malicious intent, and had many thousands of eyes on it in a matter of minutes. So it's like kind of a rare, easy call for us.
And Howard, let's talk about that one a little more, because and I think this is a common theme in these stories where, you know, each state does their elections a little differently. And when you present something about a state's election for people who are unfamiliar with it, it can sound plausible, even though it's not. Talk about the aspects of Wisconsin's, you know, same day voter registration and that sort of thing that that debunk that claim.
Yeah, well, I've noticed a couple of recurring elements in the disinfo we've seen over the past few days with regard to the election that are, you could say, are kind of specific to Wisconsin. One big one was that ballots were, quote unquote, dumped at counting centers overnight. In Wisconsin, at least, those early and absentee ballots have been sitting there for days and weeks because, of course, poll workers couldn't start counting them until Election Day under state law. We always knew there was going to be a delay in counting, and the results of the election might depend on who cast their ballots by mail. So to characterize counting them as a dump is misleading, to say the least.
Margot, have you seen 2020 being different than 2016 when we talked to you about misinformation also? Does it look different? Does it spread differently than it did 4 years ago?
Yeah, it's funny. I was thinking about that. The last time I was on talking about misinformation with you guys, it was to talk about the most widely shared article before the 2016 presidential election was an alleged affair between Hillary Clinton and Yoko Ono. I think many of us could laugh that off and we could see just the absurdity of it. Now, what we've seen 4 years later is that the tone of this misinformation has shifted dramatically. And now we're seeing it coming from the top position in office here. Donald Trump claiming victory on Wednesday in several battleground states. Eric Trump tweeting that his father won Pennsylvania. I mean, this isn't just misinformation. It's an outright lie.
We're talking about misinformation post-election as votes are still being counted. We're talking to Margo Suska from American University, assistant professor of journalism there, and Howard Hardy, elections integrity reporter at Wisconsin Watch. He's been writing about false claims, misleading stories going on. Howard, I want to look at one from before the election, because it's an example, I think, of a common type of story. And this one, I think, was more popular on the left. A picture of abandoned mailboxes attached to real concerns, I think, about changes at the U.S. Postal Service. But the captioning of the picture suggested, hey, look, the Postal Service is getting rid of all these mailboxes just in time for Election Day. It was misleading, though. Tell us about that story.
Yeah, that has become like the classic example of visual disinformation related to mail carriers and USPS in Wisconsin as related to the election. It was a photo that was presented out of context, which is super, super common. We'll often see that tactic where a photo is presented without any detail or details that mislead the viewer as to where it was taken. In this case, the photo actually was taken in Wisconsin. It was taken of a refurbishment, like spray painting facility in Hartford, Wisconsin, where they had these stacks of mailboxes in this industrial lot. And the photo and the way it was presented suggested that these were mailboxes that were getting torn out of the ground, supposedly by the Trump administration, to suppress mail-in ballots, which, of course, was not true. That was actually a fairly easily debunked piece of visual misinformation. But, you know, when the cat's out of the bag, it's really hard to get the cat back in the bag. that one really took off.
And, Margo, this is a theme I'm seeing elsewhere. Somebody filmed a picture of themselves burning what turned out to be sample ballots. Somebody threw a caption on it saying it was a poll worker burning filled out ballots. There was a picture of somebody, a news camera person, carrying in their digital equipment in a cart, and people captioned it, this is somebody smuggling in ballots or tampering equipment or something like that. I keep hearing about deep fakes and these really sophisticated things. These really unsophisticated things really take off, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and what you have is there's just this, let's remember, there's an information vacuum right now. And misinformation and disinformation, it absolutely thrives in this environment. And what I mean by that is that we are not used to waiting. We like our news fast and quick, and we like to get it from a 24-hour news station or from social media. And what we have is a record number, more than 60 million mail-in ballots that have to be counted, right? Because we're voting in the middle of a pandemic that's killed 235,000 Americans. So what we have is this waiting game, waiting for these ballots to be processed. And we don't like waiting in the United States, not for our news and not for our information. So what we have are these people who are trying to find answers, and they're finding it through these lies that are spreading. The one you mentioned, the Michigan, the Detroit ABC affiliate who had some gear in a wagon, and then all of a sudden it took off as this, you know, somebody said it was ballots that were being carted in. I mean, these are spreading on social media, and they are, I mean, it's something to be said that these are only happening in, you know, in these battleground states. And, you know, question what you're seeing. If you're seeing it on Facebook, if you're seeing it on social media, I would point right to the source. And that's my advice for your listeners right now is it a reputable news source? We've got to go back to this source judgment and recognizing reputable news sources. But of course, you've had an administration that's worked for 4 years to delegitimize the mainstream press. And this is one of the reasons why.
We heard from Scott in Menominee, who couldn't stay on the line, but wondering, Scott says, about different media technology. He doesn't think AM radio is as common anymore. What other media avenues are people plugged into that can produce this misinformation? As Howard, as you watch stories like the ones we've talked about spread, what are the most common venues?
Well, the most common venue by far is Facebook. There's just no way around it. To a far lesser extent, Twitter. Twitter has its problems as well, but honestly, they've been pretty good about pulling stuff down like fairly quickly, especially during this specific election period. But Facebook is the number one offender. They have a long way to go, in my opinion, in terms of policing their own platform. And that's where we see the vast majority of the mis and disinformation proliferate here in Wisconsin.
We are talking to Howard Hardy of Wisconsin Watch and Margot Suska of American University, looking at misinformation spreading following the election here in Wisconsin and around the nation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about fact-checking this misinformation? Are you seeing some of the stories we've talked about pop up on your Facebook page or your Twitter feed or conversations with friends and loved ones? How should the media, how should social media platforms handle these kind of things? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about falsehoods spreading about the election here in Wisconsin and around the country. Our guests are Wisconsin Watch elections reporter Howard Hardy, and Margot Suska is assistant professor of journalism at American University. She also works with Poynter's International Fact Check Network. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about some of the misinformation you've seen, how it spreads, maybe how to stop it? Have you gotten stuff that turned out to be bunk even since election day? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Bert is with us in Stevens Point. Bert, hello.
Hello. I know this sounds really simple, but I think honesty is really the biggest problem we have here. And how can we keep our politicians honest? I mean, I believe there's European countries that actually have laws to keep politicians honest. And I believe as soon as they're elected, they no longer have the freedom of speech where they can just lie.
Bert, thanks a lot for the call. Interesting question. Margot, I think there's a general perception that we can't always trust what politicians say. Is there a way to regulate that? Or short of that, how do you see the role of the media in holding politicians accountable when they do lie?
Well, I mean, I think that's what the media is designed to do. That's why the news media is referred to as the fourth estate. You know, a check on the other branches of government meant to hold government officials accountable through investigative reporting, through attending meetings, making sure that their votes and what they say are on the record. So I would encourage your listener to support groups like Wisconsin Watch, to support Wisconsin Public Media, because there are news organizations working, investigative reporters working every day to make sure that politicians are held accountable for the things that they said. We need a robust news media system in this country. And, you know, you and I have talked before that local news is unfortunately being decimated in this country. And that is my overarching concern, is that you're going to have politicians that are able to speak directly to the public unfiltered, without the role of the news media there to be a watchdog. And that is a troubling scenario moving ahead. So I would encourage your caller to support news media.
Thanks a lot for that call, Bert. Howard, can you talk about the role that you try to play in doing that at Wisconsin Watch? I mean, on one hand, you want to be out there positively reporting real stuff, but you've got this role of trying to debunk the false stuff. How do you strike that balance?
Yeah, that's always kind of a fine line to walk between producing this public service journalism that attempts to get the truth out there and also correct lies and intentional disinformation and actually unintentionally amplifying those messages with your story itself. So we always want to have some clear demonstration of harm before we jump into one of those stories. Also say that the corrective pieces always have a modest impact relative to the lies themselves. Like I wrote my debunk piece about the more votes than voters narrative as quickly as I could. But all of our stories at Wisconsin Watch go through a serious fact-checking process that can only go so fast. So by the time we published the story, several hours had gone by and quite a bit of damage had already been done. The misleading message had been shared many, many thousands of times over. So that's an ongoing problem. It's just like the relatively small reach of our corrective stories compared with the problematic content itself.
And that's, Margot, before we go back to our callers, there's an uneven playing field. When there's, as you say, a news story that's kind of stalled, we're waiting for results. A reporter like Howard is trying to carefully fact check the story before it goes out. Whereas if I want to make something up, I don't need an editor to double check it. I type and send and go. How can the media and fact checkers account for that imbalance?
Well, I mean, I think, again, it goes to your source selection. And I think that, you know, the Wisconsin, the voting claim that we were just talking about, the BBC, so the British Broadcasting Company Corporation, chose that as one of their top five myths that had to be debunked about the American election. So this has made its way now overseas. So I think that, you know, there needs to be an element of media literacy. I think it has to come back to an understanding of both the technological as well as the processes that go into news production. And I think it should be required in every elementary school curriculum, to be honest with you, especially as Facebook takes on this outsized role in so many of our lives and our information diets. We've got to explain the processes by which these platforms work and the way our news system works. And I just don't think there is a fundamental understanding anymore about how these processes operate in American society.
Talking about misinformation after the election with Margot Suska from American University, journalism prof there, and Howard Hardy, elections integrity reporter for Wisconsin Watch. Let's bring on another caller now. Reed with us in Whitehall. Reed, hi.
Hi. I just a comment. I guess with the for-profit media that we have in the U.S., I don't see that it hurts the media at all to prolong this election. I do support public news and public radio. I think it's a truer news source. I don't see how they could be hurting at this point with the election being drawn out.
Reed, thanks. Thanks a lot for the call. Reed, concerned about the profit motive, Margot, at for-profit stations and maybe affecting the way they cover things. What do you think?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, I'm actually writing a book about for-profit media, so hopefully I'll be back on in 12 to 15 months to talk about some of those findings. But I would agree. I mean, other than a few exhausted reporters who have been working for, you know, 4 or 5 days straight, this is likely good news for news media companies, for for-profit news media companies. I hope it's good news for nonprofits, which I support. But yeah, hitting that refresh button every 30 minutes, or in my case, every 3 minutes on the New York Times website, you know, is certainly driving a lot of traffic. So, but I would argue even against myself, and just to put it into perspective for your caller, which is to say the news media is also, I mean, reporters and editors and producers, we're also a part of the citizen group in the United States. And I think we want resolution as much as, you know, I hope as much as they want to generate ad revenue.
Howard, at a nonprofit group yourself, Wisconsin Watch, can you talk about your methods? When you're looking for things to debunk, how do you find them? Do you just kind of have the net open and they come to you, or do you have to seek these stories out?
I do a lot of digging through social media. It really, when I say that I'm tracking mis and disinformation online, I think a lot of people think it's a little more glamorous than it is. I do have some pretty complex dashboards set up where I can save my searches and just scroll through. But it really just comes down to a lot of scrolling and staring and trying to understand what I'm seeing.
Margo, I guess we keep touching tangentially on Facebook. Let's tackle it head on. What do you think the role of, not a company like Facebook, Facebook itself should be in trying to stop the flow of potentially harmful misinformation?
I mean, listen, Facebook is as powerful today. I mean, if you look at its revenue as some nation states in the world today, and it has got to do more. It is, and I don't think that is censorship. I think that is an obligation, and perhaps that is with partnerships with local news organizations. Maybe there's more opportunity for a local news network or local station partnerships with Facebook. But there certainly Facebook has got to open itself up to more of these, more of these criticisms of what it's allowing to be disseminated. And it's got to open its wallet to find some solutions. And I assure all of your listeners that it's got the money to be able to make some solutions that we could all benefit from.
And briefly, Howard, is Facebook the main channel where a little change there can make a big difference in the flow of misinformation?
Absolutely. I mean, they're the main platform where so many of these rumors and hoaxes and hyperpartisan pieces of content are generated and then spread from. I think they have a huge responsibility to better police their platform. And I'm particularly concerned with the hesitancy on Facebook's part to fact check the ads, the political ads that are on their platform. We've seen a lot of misleading pieces of misinformation slip through the cracks when the content is paid for.
We'll leave it there, Howard. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
And Margo, thanks for being with us again.
Okay, thanks so much.
We've been talking to Margo Suska, Assistant Professor of Journalism at American University and an assessor with Poynter's International Fact Check Network, and Howard Hardy, also with us, Elections Integrity Reporter for Wisconsin Watch. They join us to talk about fact-checking misinformation in an election week. Coming up after the news, we'll talk about pie on this week's edition of Food Friday. I'm Rob Barrett. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 6 on The Morning Show, take a trip far away from politics to explore unseen places with an underwater cave diver. That's Monday morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now it's Food Friday, though maybe we should say Food Pie Day, because we're going to talk all about pie, from how to make the best crust to how to make sure your filling doesn't end up burned onto the bottom of your oven. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about making pie? What has given you trouble in the past? Or do you have a tip you keep up your sleeve when you're making pie? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Find some recipes from our guests, by the way, at WPR.org/Food Friday. Aaron Jean McDowell is an author, baker, and contributor to a number of food publications, including Food 52. Her new book is The Book on Pie, Everything You Need to Know to Bake Perfect Pies. Aaron, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Sometimes, Aaron, I read a cookbook and I say to myself, this person really loves the subject of the book they've written about. I feel that with you and pie. Am I right?
You are so right. This feels like the book I was meant to write. I love pie so much, and I just never seem to run out of things to say about it.
And you love, part of why you give a five-step love letter to Pi, all the things you like about it to begin the book. And one of the things is just the, I think that the tactile sense, the actual doing of it and the working the crust. Talk about just the joy you find in the making of a pie.
I'm so glad that you bring that up because especially right now, I just find the process of making pie incredibly calming. There's something about your hands touching the flour. I recommend that people make and mix pie dough by hand. Though, of course, there are exceptions if you're a person with exceptionally warm hands. But I think that there's just something about getting in there, getting your hands dirty a little bit and making something entirely from scratch. And that's something that is so satisfying when baking anything, but there's just something about a pie that's comforting from the moment you get the ingredients out till the moment it lands on your plate.
And another thing I love, another of your favorite things about pie is that you love teaching other people about pie making. Why does that bring you joy?
One of the reasons I love teaching about pie is because I just think that there's a lot of recipes out there that have sort of led people astray. And one of the reasons I think that is because pie making is, you know, a lot of us have inherited recipes from our grandmothers or other family members. And there's a lot of ways that the recipes are worded sometimes that might kind of lead you down the wrong path. One of the things that I notice is a lot of recipes are so cautious about adding too much liquid that a lot of people end up with this sort of dry, crumbly dough that's very hard to roll out. So I really just like helping people find those light bulb moments, figuring out that one thing that was the struggle that they've been having this whole time, and suddenly the door is open and they can bake perfect pies.
Let's talk about some more practical advice like that. My hang up on making my own pie crust is rolling things out. And I'm just, whatever kind of thing I try to make, pastry, whatever, rolling it out, it always goes wrong. I can't get it thin enough. It sticks to the roller. I'm kind of traumatized. Help me out.
So when it comes to the dough being easy to roll out, that is all about the hydration of the dough, which I just started mentioning because it's really one of the biggest issues that I find with most people at home. When a dough is too dry, as I mentioned, it'll be sort of stiff and crumbly. It would be likely to crack when you're rolling it out. And I hear people say that a lot, that I tried to roll it out, but the dough just kept cracking. That means it's too dry. What you're talking about with the dough sticking to everything usually means it's a little bit too wet. You obviously need to use a little bit of flour when you're rolling dough out, but you shouldn't have to use that much. It should sort of be smooth, but not sticky. So that's one of the reasons why a lot of recipes kind of provide a range for moisture. And I always say that pie baking is a lot more muscle memory than a lot of other baking. So I provide in my new cookbook a lot of visual cues so that you can see what a just right dough looks like right next to one that's too dry or right next to one that's too wet, so that you can actually hold your dough up and say, did I get it right? Because sometimes seeing it is really the only way you're going to know.
We're talking to Erin Jean McDowell about her new book, The Book on Pie, Everything You Need to Know to Bake Perfect Pies. You can join the Food Friday conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your Pie Triage 101 questions or your own advice for others, or just tell us about your favorite kind of pie to eat. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Well, you have shared some recipes with us, and they look really good, Erin. Let's tackle one of them now. We've got this up at WPR.org/Food Friday, a cranberry orange pie. This is great for the season. Tell us about this guy.
I love this pie because cranberries, I think, are a bit of an underutilized pie filling ingredient, possibly because they're sour. But I think it's also interesting. Cranberries thicken really beautifully. So unlike a lot of other fruit where you have to add flour or cornstarch or tapioca starch, some kind of starch-based thickener to get that filling thick, when it comes to cranberries, they thicken enough all on their own. So that actually makes it a very beginner-friendly pie. I dress this pie up just a tiny bit by adding a second layer, this creamy cream cheese orange layer, because I love the way orange and cranberries go together. So the idea is, not only is this a really good looking and simple pie to achieve, but when you slice it, you actually see two visible layers in each slice, a layer of white cream and a layer of juicy cranberry filling.
And I'm hearing cranberry and orange is my main filling ingredients. Is it going to be too tart for me?
See, I don't think so. The orange just kind of complements the cranberry. But if you want to really take it to the next level, you could always top it with a meringue topping. This is something I love with cranberries. You know, lemon meringue is a very common pie, right? But why not a cranberry meringue? Why not, you know, any kind of tart ingredient, give it that little extra boost of sweetness? But I put plenty of brown sugar in with the cranberries so that you get that nice sweetness and balance it all out.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Lindsay is with us in Madison. Lindsay, hi.
Hi. I had a quick question about pie filling. I've heard that, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right, sous vide helps keep the, if you do that and cook it, I think that's like around water, that it keeps the fruit more at an even temperature, and then the fruit actually stays more intact. But it still gets cooked?
Lindsay, so thanks that's for the call. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. Sous vide is a technique where food is sort of sealed in a bag and then submerged in water. I have to admit, I don't have a ton of experience using it to make pie fillings, but what she's describing does make sense. If you're trying to keep the fruit a little bit more intact, sous vide is a very gentle form of cooking. But what I would actually encourage you to do is, it just sort of depends what kind of goal you're going for. So if you're trying to maintain firmer fruit in your final pie, if you like bits of whole cherries or bits of whole peaches, bits of whole apple, you actually just want to consider that in your method of preparation and not do anything that's going to cause it to break down too much initially, you know, prior to baking. So you can also opt for using slightly firmer fruit. You know, you might actually look at it and say, is that fruit a little out of season? Is that fruit good for baking? But fruit that's a little bit firmer is going to hold its shape better through cooking and baking both.
Thanks for that call, Lindsay. And did I see this advice and get it right in your book, Aaron? If it's a, you know, underripe fruit or overripe fruit, we might think more about pre-cooking it. If it's perfectly ripe stuff, then maybe it's ready to just go right in and bake and have that freshness to it.
Absolutely. One of the things that I talk about when it comes to fruit pies is understanding that seasonality and exactly how in season it is and how juicy it is going to be crucial to getting it that sliceable consistency and not having a pie that runneth over.
Okay, now here's a pie I'm very curious about. Birthday cake pie. Tell us about this, Ed. I like everything about the sound of that.
I love birthdays and I like cake, but I love pie. So why do cakes get to have all the birthday fun? This is the question on my mind. So that was what I was thinking about when we created this birthday cake pie. My amazing assistant actually helped me kind of create this recipe. And we sort of tried to channel the flavors of something along the lines of funfetti. And then it's topped with a chocolate whipped cream. So you actually get kind of that actual cake feeling, but you also get my favorite part of pie, which is the flaky crust.
Let's bring on another caller at 800-642-1234. We've got that birthday cake pie, I should mention, at WPR.org/Food Friday. Russ joins us next in Pleasant Springs. Russ, hi.
Hi. I eat pie several times a year, you know, traditional pumpkin pie and maybe strawberry rhubarb at Christmas. But my favorite pies are the ones that have two favorite pies, the fruit pies with crisscross crust across the top, and chocolate banana cream pie. And I can't find my bakery, local bakery here downtown, does not make either one of those. Are those very hard pies to get together?
Well, you got to lobby them, Russ. Put some pressure on them to carry your pie. Let's start with that crisscross top that he likes. You've got some of that. You got a lot of topping options in your book. What goes in? What kind of labor goes into that?
So the crisscross that you're talking about is a lattice crust. And lattice crust can be done very easily and in an unwoven style where they're kind of just laid on top of the pie, or they can be woven, which is a little bit more complicated. But in my book, I break down that lattice process. And I would argue that doing a lattice is not that much harder than doing just a top crust on your pie. It just takes a little bit of practice. And in my book, I talk about a different kinds of lattice and rank them kind of from easiest to hardest. So if you're someone who isn't very skilled at pies, but you still want to try a lattice, you're going to want to try my fat lattice, which I affectionately nicknamed Fattis. It's very easy for even beginners to do. It's very wide strips of dough, so it doesn't require that much weaving. I love this other request, though, about the chocolate banana cream pie, because that was one of the things that I was trying to accomplish when I wrote this book. I'm sort of known for my pies, and I would get people asking me all the time, I see you did a peach pie recipe, but I want a plum pie recipe. Everyone's always asking about their favorite flavor. My idea with writing this book is that you would be able to mix and match components. You could take your favorite crust, your favorite filling, your favorite toppings to create those dream pies, the pies that you kind of fantasize about. There is a great chocolate cream filling in the book, and there's a great banana cream pie recipe in the book. You could absolutely mash those together. And I always say that the best pies are homemade pies. So if your bakery isn't carrying it, maybe it's time for you to get out your rolling pin.
Yeah, and you can start selling them to the bakery, Russ. So we're talking to Era Jean McDowell about pie. It's Food Friday. Her latest book is The Book on Pie, Everything You Need to Know to Bake Perfect Pies. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your pie-related questions and thoughts and favorites. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Find a few recipes from Erin at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll continue the pie conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we pick up our pie conversation on this week's edition of Food Friday. Erin Jean McDowell is with us. Her new book is The Book on Pie, Everything You Need to Know to Bake Perfect Pies. Let's go back to you and your calls at 800-642-1234. Kathy is with us in Wisconsin Dells. Kathy, hi.
Hi. Hello. I have a question for you. Maybe you alluded to this before. I just turned on the radio. I'm in the car. But no matter how many apples I put in a pie, and I use like Granny Smith or an apple that you're supposed to use, no matter how high I stack it, it always seems that it always sinks way down and it looks like I didn't put many apples in it. So,
yep, that's like the potato chip syndrome of the suddenly the bag doesn't have nearly as many as I thought it did when it opened it up. That's a great question. Mm-hmm. I find that pre-cooking the apple filling is actually what helps you kind of prevent that gap. What's happening when you're, no matter, even if you're packing it full of apples, apples contain a lot of moisture. And as they cook in the oven, the sugar is drawing moisture out of the apples. And that is causing them to shrink the way that a lot of fruits and vegetables shrink as they start to cook. And that's why they shrink away from the crust. If you cook your apple filling and let it cool before you assemble your pie, then you don't have that issue happening as much because already some of that moisture loss has already happened before the pie even hits the oven.
Pre-cook the apples. Hope that helps, Kathy. Thanks a lot for calling in. Lots of callers here. Let's go to Sandra now with us in Mount Pleasant. Sandra, hi.
Hi. As far as the crust goes, I have an old Better Homes and Gardens cookbook with an oil pastry in it. And you sift together the flour and salt, and you use oil and a little bit of milk. And I can use expeller press canola oil and whole wheat pastry flour. And you roll it in between two pieces of wax paper, and it's totally forgivable because if it doesn't work out, once you flip it into the pie plate, you just take your thumb and fix it. It's like working with Play-Doh or something, but it really turns out well and it tastes good. So it's called oil pastry.
Interesting. Thanks a lot for that call, Sandra. Erin, is that one you work with? And also, if you just have thoughts on the different, she mentioned canola oil in it, the different options of fats to use in our pie crust.
Yeah, so in my book, I talk about all different kinds of fats that you can use. I love the suggestion of a more flexible oil-based pastry. A lot of times those pastry doughs are a little bit less flaky and a little bit crumblier, which isn't a bad thing. It means exactly what our listener was saying, which is that you can kind of press it in. And it's a little bit more forgiving in that way. Inside the book on pie, I have recipes for press-in crusts, including some oil-based press-in crust and crust that you roll out with a rolling pin. So there are definitely crusts of all types. There's actually over 40 different kinds of crusts inside the book.
And yeah, that thanks a lot for that call. I have made, like, I think it was called a pat in the pan crust. And that definitely is more my speed because you don't have to roll those first necessarily, right?
That's exactly right. And also, a lot of times they don't require as much chilling. So some people say, oh, pie takes a little bit of time. And that's because typically at various stages you have to chill it. But some of those press-in crusts, they can go right into the oven.
Thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. It's Food Friday. We're talking to Erin Jean McDowell about her new book, The Book on Pie, Everything You Need to Know to Bake Perfect Pies. Back to your calls. Leland is with us in Sturgeon Bay. Leland, hello.
Yeah, how are you doing?
Good. What do you want to tell us about?
Well, I just have a question about pie thickeners. A lot of times I'll use, and a lot of recipes call for tapioca, like instant tapioca or the tapioca pearls. And I like to use that because it seems to have a neutral flavor. But I was curious about tapioca flour. If you can substitute the tapioca flour as a thickener instead of using the quicker tapioca or the pearls. And if you can, is it a 1-to-1 ratio, or is there is there a different ratio for substituting?
Instant tapioca versus tapioca flour as a thickener in our pies, Erin.
So one of the things that's so great about tapioca flour, which also can be called tapioca starch. So just in case you go to the grocery store and you're looking and all you see is tapioca flour and you're looking for tapioca starch, those are actually the same thing. Just they can be labeled the same. So tapioca is a stronger thickener than cornstarch, which is one of the thickeners that I use most frequently only because it's one of the most readily available. So when you are wanting to replace tapioca in any way with a recipe that would use cornstarch, you are going to need double the amount that you need for the cornstarch. It's stronger, but that's what it necessitates to achieve that same level of thickening. When it comes to using the flour versus the pearls, I would really strongly recommend that you give that a test first, because it's not going to be a 1-to-1, because one is a powder and one is in more of a solid form. So what I would do is I would look for a recipe that uses cornstarch and figure out the ratio of what to add that way, rather than trying to convert from pearl to tapioca starch or tapioca flour.
All right. Hope that helps, Leland. All right. Let's go to Blue now with us in Green Bay. Blue, hello.
Hey. So on the subject of pies, I've heard of so many different types of fruit pies, but I don't think I've ever heard of a grape pie.
Grape pie. Interesting.
Ooh, I'm so glad. I'm sorry I jumped right on you there, because that's actually my favorite flavor of pie is Concord grape pie. I love a grape pie, and I first learned about them when I went away to college. I went to college in the Hudson Valley in New York. I had a friend from way upstate New York, and she introduced me to the Concord grape pie. Grapes are tricky to bake with because they're so juicy, but if you can get it right, they make this incredible, juicy, jammy filling that is just killer. So I thank you for allowing me to just gush over one of my favorite flavors of pie, which is actually Concord grape pie, and they're in season right now.
We just have thanks for that call. Just a minute or so left. You also do savory pies. I don't want to, ignore those completely. And you gave us a recipe for a sweet and spicy kale and squash pativiers.
It's a French word. So thus the difficult to pronounce, but it is a double crust puff pastry pie. And the filling for this one is amazing. You just roast everything together on a sheet pan, let it cool, and then you pop it between two layers of puff pastry, and it is an amazing savory pie. I love an excuse to eat pie for dinner.
Now, in our last a few moments now, what is next on your pie agenda?
Well, right now I'm baking with what's in season, so I'm baking a lot of apple and pear and quince pies, and just making my house smell amazing with all those apple and pear and quince pies, I would say.
Fantastic. Erin, thanks so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you so much for having me.
Erin Jean McDowell is a baker and cookbook author. Her latest book is called The Book on Pie, Everything You Need to Know to Bake Perfect Pies. She joined us to talk about, yes, pie on this week's edition of Food Friday. You can find the recipes she shared. You can find them online at WPR.org/Food Friday. What all do we have there? A rough puff pastry. Didn't even really talk about that too much. The sweet and spicy kale and squash pativier. maybe. Basic crumb crust, the birthday cake pie. Make that for me. And a cranberry orange pie. Again, those are all online at WPR.org/food Friday. And you can keep telling us about your own favorite pies and your favorite ways to make them. You can do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Share your own pie wisdom while you're there. That's the Ideas Network Facebook page. That's the sound of a tenor saxophone played by me. I shared it on Facebook back in the spring when it was clear I was going to miss performing and practicing with my band. I usually wouldn't share that on the air. I don't like to toot my own horn, but today is a special day. It's National Saxophone Day. It marks the birthday of Adolf Sax, the inventor of the instrument who gave it its name. Adolf Sax was born in Belgium on November 6, 1814. In 1846, he received a 15-year patent for the saxophone. He made them in a lot of shapes and sizes. Some of them are still used today. Some, like the saxotromba and the sax tuba, not so much. Now, I like the saxophone because you can use it to make pretty classical sounds. You can also use it to make some really nasty rock and jazz sounds, too. Here's a little of me doing that from a band practice a couple years back. Happy Saxophone Day.